Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. My name is Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
And we're back this week with a superb episode with Jeremy Pritchard, who's the bassist in the band Everything Everything. And this is, you know, one of my favourite ones we've ever done. It was a really nice in-person one as well, which we're, you know, luckily those are sort of coming around more often. So it was again a sort of beer and pizza one, and a great evening.
It was really good. I think we are both so jealous of his life because he plays in a really cool band. He's really handsome, he's really tall, and he's got loads of lovely
really
bass
nice.
Guitars, and he's really nice, yeah. It was brilliant. No, it's fascinating to talk about, because Everything is such a kind of interesting technical band, and I think that's where it got interesting in the Beatles chat, because it's talking about kind of a lot of the intricacies, the technical things Paul McCartney's doing, elements of production and things, and yeah, it was just really, really fun. He's so passionate and knowledgeable as well.
Yeah, and he really knows his onions sort of musically and historically. We did our first proper deep dive. I mean, we've got sort of skirted around Paul's bass playing, and we're both massive fans, but we've never done quite as deep a dive as into his sort of melodic sensibilities and with that instrument. So that was really, really fascinating chat, and really, you know, really interesting to talk to someone who is a proper bassist and a brilliant bassist, and for whom bass is such an integral part of everything, but not in a very conventional way. And they do tend to sort of snake around, and they are very much their own melodic lines and stuff. So it's a really, there's a really interesting parallel with those. And it was just, I think, a really, really brilliant insight into bass playing in general.
I think we did touch on this as well, about the idea that, you know, being the bass player was kind of the short straw when you were joining a band. But now, as you get older, it's like, I love playing the bass, and there's so much you can do with it, and it's so fun to lock in to a groove and everything. And, you know, the simplicity of it is what makes it so interesting, you know?
And some of the most fun lines to write as well, because, you know, you can add a whole another dimension to a song, which is something we talk about with things like Baby, You're a Rich Man and something in this podcast. We also talk about Jeremy's sort of early influences growing up, listening to a lot of post rock and stuff like Slint and Tortoise, which are also quite big touchstones for us. So, but yeah, that was interesting, seeing how the Beatles is a very big influence on the band. Radiohead we sort of mention as well, but those sort of quite cerebral and, you know, very complicated and very musically proficient bands of the early 90s. And if you want to hear an extended version of this episode, you can join our Patreon, where you can get ad-free extended versions of every single podcast. And there's a really good extra section in this where we talk quite in-depth, expanding on Jeremy's controversial Beatles opinion, which is one of the all-time greats.
It is a really good one. Yeah.
And very controversial, I think.
I don't know, though. I don't know if it is going to be that controversial, because
I think a lot of people, I mean, we spend a lot of the time in this podcast trying to guess what it is, because it gives us a hint at the beginning. But see if you got to the same conclusion that we did. But I think there's going to be people up in arms about that.
Really? I don't know about that. But yeah, it's a good one.
So yeah, join the Patreon. Please do continue to leave nice reviews for us if you listen on Apple Podcast. We're really thrilled when we get a good five-star, and it really helps people find the podcast and, you know, puts us up those Apple charts, and which, you know, helps people find us. So we're really grateful for that. You can follow us on the old social media. We haven't got any correspondence this week because it's quite a long episode, so we'll sort of crack on. But if you do want to get in touch, you can email us in the usual place by going to personalbeatles.com/contact or emailing me, Jack@homespunsounds.com. Robin, you got the guitar there?
Well, I was doing a thing where I was... We talked a lot this series about the lovely descending guitar lines mm-hmm. in Beatles songs and how often they appear. And this is... Basically, I listened to an Elliott Smith song recently, and it's got... I mean, we've talked a lot about how the Beatles are a big influence on Elliott Smith, and he covered Because and everything. And mm-hmm. There's a song he wrote called Oh Well OK, which is on XO, and it's got one of the best descending bits ever, really. It starts like this. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful kind of... the ambiguity of a minor seventh or a sixth. You know how they're the same chords? Mm-hmm. Like So it's an A sixth, and it kind of goes down, or an F sharp minor seven, kind of goes down. And but when it goes all the way down, it's back into F sharp, so it becomes the minor seven. It's so clever, the kind of...
That is really cool.
And it's so Lennon White Album, I think.
Yeah, well, it's quite Michelle-y as well.
Yeah. And the amazing thing about that song as well is the kind of chorus end. So it's in A or F sharp minor, and the chorus ends on this E minor 7 chord. And when it goes to the instrumental, he starts the song again, but now in the key of E minor, because he's got this E minor 7, so he starts the kind of... And so basically he's modulated nearly like an entire octave, but without you noticing. So he's gone from...
Yeah, I mean, a very strange key to end up in when you start in F-sharp minor.
Yeah, yeah, you start in F-sharp minor and then you're in E minor. And then what that does
And that's very like Julia as well.
Yeah, totally. I thought Julia. Thing. And then, of course, when it gets to the last chorus, you're in this new key. So his voice is nearly an octave higher than it was at the start. And it just totally lifts the song. You know, so much higher, and it gives it this emotional intensity. And it's one of those things where it's like, that's Elliott Smith being so... I can't think of... Can you think of a Beatles song that's got a key change? I'm sure there is one.
They definitely don't tend to sort of hop into the relative minor or relative major very often. And they certainly don't do sort of cheesy semitone key steps.
No. I think that song is so Lennon, but the kind of ingeniousness of it is very McCartney, I think. You know,
it's undoubtedly Beatlesy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So instantly.
And I just, it's such a great song, and it's on the playlist.
We'll put it on the playlist, yeah.
I was listening to that last week and just thought, God, that's so good and so clever, but not in a way that you really know. You don't even notice it changes key, you just notice it gets to this new kind of level of intensity in the last chorus. And it's just, he was just a remarkable songwriter, really.
Amazing. Hmm. Yeah, so we have an ongoing playlist of all the songs that we mentioned on this podcast from every episode. So you can go to our social media accounts at Personal Beatles on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all that, and we'll post links to that. We won't keep you any longer, as I say, every week. and we'll be back at the end to sort of tease what's coming up. But thank you very much for listening. Really hope you enjoy this episode. Here is Jeremy Pritchard's Personal Beatles. So this week we are delighted to be joined by Jeremy Pritchard.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm really good, Yeah, it was nice of you to get in touch with us. And
this is the thing, I actually asked to do this, which isn't very cool. It turns out I'm a huge fan. I heard the Laura Barton episode that you recorded, and... I know Laura a little bit through various mutual friends and through music and stuff, and within 10 minutes of that episode, I'd messaged her on Instagram and said, yeah, I want to do this.
Nice.
And to my great surprise, you actually let me. So here we are a week later.
Yeah.
No, if you don't know Jeremy's work in the band Everything Everything, Robin and I are big fans of your output over the decade or so. So we were like, that was a bit of a no-brainer, really, wasn't it?
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks, lads. Definitely.
So, I mean, you play bass in the band?
I play bass in Everything. We started a band in 2007, having finished university. I've been at university with John. He brought in a couple of his school friends, and we're still doing it 14 years later.
That's great. That is pretty
which
amazing.
Does feel like a long time now.
What were you studying? Was it, were you doing music?
We were doing music, yeah. Right. And Mike was doing music at Leeds College of Music. Me and John were at Salford University. And then Mike moved to Manchester to join us.
And was it production or like composition?
It was all sorts. Yeah. I got quite interested in the critical theory side of it.
Right.
Basically doing this sort of thing, having a can and talking about and theorising. Yeah. Which took me by surprise because it was I kind of felt that I'd covered, somewhat hubristically, I felt when I was 19 and I got to university, having had a year out, I thought, oh, I've done all this. I know all this. and the only thing that was totally brand new to me was critical theory, which is a strange discipline whereby you apply the criteria of French literary critics to Bob Dylan. And to begin with, I thought, what the hell is this bollocks? And then it's something clicked and I became really fascinated with that. So I ended up doing a sort of dissertation... through that medium, as it were.
Yeah.
It's funny how, like, there's quite a lot of conspiracy theories basically around exactly what you did now, aren't there?
Yeah.
In terms of the cultural Marxism kind of thing. Oh, they're just filling students' heads with this French bullshit kind of thing.
Yeah, I was very glad to be jar-headed in that way. Yeah.
It's so weird, isn't it? Like, where did that come from? I suppose it just comes from, they're deconstructing everything. Like, what is the root of that conspiracy theory?
I don't know, and I don't know why it would be a bad thing to unpick meaning and significance and cultural significance. Why that would be a threat to society.
I think there's just the thing that it's like, oh, you know, it's the Marxist readings and, you know, you end up... The cultural Marxism is to do with like Hollywood, isn't it? They think like Hollywood is pushing a Marxist. Is that one of the lines? I don't know.
Well, that sort of goes back to sort of McCarthyism, I suppose. That's where the roots are. But I mean, I certainly didn't do much cultural Marxism in my music degree.
Where did you go?
Well, I had a very similar time and like because I was at Leeds and graduated the same year.
Oh right,
at Leeds Uni. So I did think because there were sort of people who that I mean, I think Alt J were in my year at Leeds, and then when I started listening to everything, I did think back in at that time that one of you was somewhere around that scene.
Yeah, mine so that makes sense. Was at the College of Music, and I think his degree was accredited by Leeds University or something.
Right, because I had a similar thing to you where I arrived there and I was like, done all this.
Yeah.
But then I sort of stupidly jumped into Well, I think it's a fault of like the gap between like the way music's taught in schools.
That's true.
And what university courses were, especially if you like did A level and did quite well at it.
Mm.
Then you covered a lot of the bases in the first year is basically redoing a lot of stuff
that's true. Yeah.
Personally I had already done, so I was
because I'd done a lot of gigging. I'd done a certain amount of sort of miniature cobbled together tours, and the actual lifestyle of being in a band I'd kind of been living at least in my head since I was about 15. Yeah. So it wasn't really it wasn't new to me to play with other people. It wasn't new to me to live that way, as it were.
Mm.
So what was Jonathan studying then at that time?
He was doing the same course as me,
but
he was more concentrating on the production side of it because he's always been quite an adept engineer, really, especially in the sort of solipsistic way on his own software, on his own, producing himself, and composition. And as he famously claimed, and this is true, he never did anything, especially for an assignment. If we were told, you've got to compose something that incorporates this technique and this technique and this technique, or to produce something that incorporates this particular sound or this particular technique, recording technique, he would just go back through his own archives and find something that fitted the bill.
Really? Yeah.
And so he never wrote anything especially for the course.
Yeah.
And he came out with the highest composition mark.
Really?
That popular music and recording at Salford University had ever seen in those days. I'd be surprised if he's been hipped to it since. But he was also amazingly arrogant.
Really?
You know, it's just it was just easy. I just had all this stuff already.
That's crazy.
But you know, he was like that. He was very talented at that time.
So did you guys bond over I mean, you take your name from a Radiohead track. Is that true or is that apocryphal?
That was true, but we didn't realise. It was it was completely subconscious.
Right.
And yeah, we did love Radiohead. We liked the name because we liked it written down. We liked the rhythm of it. There's a musicality to it. Mm. And we liked the sort of sense of possibility and boundlessness and all that. And then we just put Kid A on one day and went, oh, fuck. Obviously, that's what it is.
Yeah. But it seems to work well with a kind of maximalist approach.
Yeah,
of
exactly. Band, yeah, and I still like it, actually. I still like it as a name. It's a bit of a mouthful. Yeah. You certainly got sick of typing that word.
Did you bond over Beatles tracks as
we
well?
We did. Mm.
If you're doing a music production course, does the kind of Beatles stuff come into it as well when you're learning kind of things to do with, like, mixing or, like...
Certainly compositionally,
yeah,
they would be referenced. And I think on the production side, which I kind of peeled off from at some point during, like, the second year anyway, they must have been held up as pioneering in that respect as well, because they just were. But I remember doing a presentation quite early on in the first year because nobody else put their hand up. And when I had to kind of deconstruct Tomorrow Never Knows and sitting at the piano and kind of saying, the bass stays on the C even when the chord goes down to the B flat.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoyed doing. And I wrote a lot of early essays that I had to do for the course about the Beatles because I just felt comfortable there.
Right.
And because there's enough material. There's enough within the music, but then there's also enough source material. If you go into the library, there's a lot of writing about the Beatles, and some of it's really bad, but a lot of it is really good.
Yeah.
And there's enough to go at. So academically, they're quite a rich scene.
Yeah, And so to go back to Jack's question then, did you and Jonathan bond over that?
We did, but he also, unlike me, he has a much more healthy distrust of kind of canonising rock music and pop music. And I think he just likes them when he likes them and he likes what he likes about them. He doesn't have the sort of forensic, this is on this album and this matters because of this knowledge that I am really boorish with. he's much more casual with his love of it. And much more, I suppose it's much more, it's not more emotional, but he has a less overthought connection to that band than I do. Because this is just the way that I engage with culture generally. I tend to do the deep dive on anything I really love.
Yeah.
I've done that with a lot of, my favourite bands. The thing that they have in common is that they project something beyond the music itself and beyond the individuals involved, that there's a kind of collective magic that projects this whole other world aesthetically that you can immerse yourself in.
Yeah.
So I love Kraftwerk for that reason.
Yeah.
And I love the Beatles for that reason. And I love the Smiths for that reason. I love Blur even for that reason. There's a sense of sort of camaraderie that comes across as well with all these acts. Even Kraftwerk.
Yeah. There is, definitely.
There is, at least for the sort of classic period. And that is something that I'm always really happy to indulge in.
I think there's a really interesting analogy to be made with the music of Germany in the 70s and the music of Britain in the 60s, really. Because I think Germany was having a kind of similar renaissance in the 70s. Like, I think there's it was a world of possibility.
Totally.
And it's about building a new history post-war. And
Starting again.
Yeah, exactly.
Post-war consensus has everything to do with the Beatles and with European music as well.
Yeah, exactly, definitely. How do you see those influences kind of getting into everything? Because for me, it's very technical and complicated music, but there's a lot of heart, but there's a quite a proggy element as well. Do you think
I think that just the general attitude of the Beatles to change from one record to the next, but still maintain an identity.
Yeah.
Only augmenting that identity, never diluting it or cheapening it in any way.
Yeah.
That's something that we've taken on board, really. Sort of spirit of radicalism,
yes.
I suppose.
Mm. Yeah.
Or we've tried to absorb that. Mm. And then there are other times when we're just... Because I don't think we sound like them, really. But there are times when we are doing their thing as well. There's just a couple of moments here and there.
Yeah.
There's a song called White Whale at the end of our fourth album called A Fever Dream.
Mm.
And the second half of that song, we are just doing a Beatles song.
Really?
Yeah.
Which song?
It's just this,
it's the spirit, really.
Yeah.
And it's the sound of the drums, it's the way they're played, and the way the backing vocals are sung, and that descending bass line thing. A major chord with a A at the bottom of it, and then a G at the bottom of it, and then an F. You know, that thing.
Happiness is a warm gun.
Yeah, exactly, and like so many other things. Me a bit of I'm the Walrus specifically, something about the sort of tumbling chords but there's even a way you can make a hi-hat sound that makes me think of the Beatles. I was thinking about this recently, how they sound quite heavy, the Beatles, and I think that's a really good thing. I think it's one of the ways in which they've transcended the 60s better than their contemporaries is because the bass and drums are really fucking loud. And that makes them sound quite modern.
Yeah.
And I think it's I think with every remaster, the fact that the rhythm section are the surviving members means you get more weight and presence from the drums and bass with every remaster. And actually, they just sound better and better as a result. And they sound, they really compete.
Yeah.
You can put Paperback Writer on. In the club now, and it's going to move people because it slaps.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And a lot of that was sort of technical limitations of, they always wanted to push that rhythm section as much as they possibly could. And now that's why there's just, they really shine on the Giles Martin ones, because you do think, I mean, Geoff Noyd made the point that it is the surviving members saying, turn me up.
But I don't think that's a band thing.
If there's a
band that could take it.
Yeah.
I think you also, even in the original recordings, you get a real weight from the bass guitar from about Pepper onwards, really. Especially on that album, it seems really loud. It's really loud on Mystery Tour. I think maybe because he was playing guitar or piano in the basic track a bit more, and then he would overdub the bass at the end. And he'd be the last thing to go down. I've heard or read at some point. Just go straight into the desk, last thing to go down. So he's got everything to pull at musically. And I also heard that he would tune himself ever so slightly sharp just to stand out of the track. I'm sure that probably isn't true, at least not deliberately, but I also don't know how they would have been tuning apart from by ear in those days. So,
well, I think his Hofner bass was a bit out of tune.
I've got one interesting that you can't really get beyond the 10th fret without having...
That's a really good bit. This is the George Martin book about the making of Sgt. Pepper. But there's a really good bit about...
Which book is this?
This is called Summer of Love.
Oh, right.
It's really good. It was to do... It came out around the time the South Bank special came out. The 25th anniversary. But it was basically George Martin talking about, like, the whole thing in the 60s was about trying to... Early 60s, about trying to make records as loud as possible. And American records seemed to be so much louder. There's a bit where he says he would get a 7-inch and he could see the depth of the grooves and stuff like that. And then it sort of... So the whole object was to try and get those bass and drums loud. And then he says, we must have done something right, because later on, even much later on, recording artists would come up to me and say in their turn, why can't we get our records to sound like the Beatles? They would listen to the bass guitar on Baby You're a Rich Man and say, hey man, that's a terrific sound. How the hell did he get a bass sound like that? Make ours sound that good. But really, underneath it all was the driving power of the blues demanding loudness. It's really good.
That's really interesting.
But Baby You're a Rich Man is one I think of where the bass is just like absolutely floods out the speakers, doesn't it?
It does,
So good.
I think that's the best drum sound as well, is actually on Mystery Tour, the best drum sound of their whole career. It's really heavy and hip-hoppy. It's got loads of top and loads of bottom, and it's really punchy and loud in the mix. And that really makes those songs stand up in the modern era.
That you know who you are. What do you want to be?
So you, did you say you have a Hoffman bass?
I've got one that's very... It's basically the same guts, and it's got a slightly different body shape. I couldn't let myself have one, because it's just so synonymous with one person.
Yeah.
But I've got a club...
What, the bass player from Deerhoof?
Yeah, with her. I've got the club bass equivalent, which is a different body shape, but basically the same sound.
Ding dong. For me as a guitarist, I don't think guitar shapes don't vary as radically as sort of bass shapes, but does it make you play in a completely different way if you're playing an old vintage German style bass like that? Because
it's the sound really, and how synonymous that is with, and even the feel of it, because it's short scale, it's got flat wound strings, the action is relatively high, it doesn't feel like a modern instrument at all.
Mm.
And then you play one note and you immediately think of McCartney. Mm. And then you immediately want to play in that way.
Which is not a bad thing. With flat wound strings.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And this is something else that I didn't really grasp for a long time. Always has done, which is why he has, despite playing with a pick, this really low, pillowy, knocky, dubby sound, which is so brilliant. And I couldn't understand that he was a pick player in the same way that Sid Vicious was.
Yeah.
Not Sid Vicious. Who's the other one? It was Sid Vicious.
Well, Steve Jones played all the bass on Sex Pistols. And that's true. Like, phenomenal.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's not a punky sound at all. Of course it isn't. And yet he was a pick player.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get my head around that until I was about 25 when I finally understood that flat wound strings existed, which is why it basically sounds more like a double bass or something like that.
And we were just chatting then while we were eating pizza. I mean, Paul McCartney was a guitarist first and then became a bass player. And I think some ways that explains his kind of... his bass playing is kind of playing to be heard in the mix.
Yeah,
I think,
he's not seeing it as a backline role and it's very melodic. But the other thing about this famous myth, John and George, they said... I'm not going to do the voice. They said, you know, famously, one of them needed to play bass.
Yeah.
And John and George said, I'm not doing it.
Hmm.
And so he picked up the slack.
Yeah.
The thing is, that's the only way anybody ends up playing bass. No one thinks, I'm not interested in the guitar.
Mm.
I want to play bass.
Yeah.
They are related. Of course they are.
Yeah.
Mm. I wanted to play the guitar when I was 12. And I remember like begging my dad, who was a musician as well, saying, I really want an electric guitar.
Mm.
And him being like, well, get an acoustic, and if you stick with it, you can have an electric. And buying a steel string, 3/4 size Hohner, which was so difficult to play.
Yeah.
I really hurt my hands. And
that
was quite a chore, really. And actually, if I had got an electric, it would have been less hard work physically. Mm. But, and also because I'd been a cellist as a kid at school, I kind of subconsciously understood the role of a bass instrument, I think, that supporting line.
Yeah.
Our school had an electric bass and just a load of acoustic guitars, and I was very drawn to this plug-in instrument, which was cool.
Yeah.
So I ended up playing bass, but also because everybody else had bought a guitar and everybody else had bought drums and everybody else wanted to be the singer. And if you're going to fill in the blanks and join in, which is what playing bass is about, really, then somebody has to put their hand up and say, all right, I'll do that.
Yeah, if you're a bassist or a drummer, you're never going to be short of a gig, really.
No, that's true, as it turned out. Yeah. I got to university, I had to do loads of modules I wasn't actually studying.
I remember having that chat in the band I was in when I was like, at school, I must have been about 14, and it was me, my brother, and my friend Daniel, and we all wanted to play guitar, and it was such a kind of short straw thing. It was like, all right, I'll do bass, but you have to say the songs are written by me, and I can still play guitar in my spare time. Like, I was really like,
a lot of people see it as a demotion. And I think
I got offered to go do a little mini tour by a band that I'd been on a bill with, nothing major. And I was quite excited that they had asked me, and then they asked me to play bass, and I was such little shit that I was absolutely affronted by the idea of it. But I really regret that. It's such a stupid thing to do because it would have been such an amazing experience.
I love playing bass now.
Oh, I'd also really never picked up a bass before.
But it's to do with being young, isn't it? You want to be the lead guitarist.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you do. It's not and cool, I was the same. And I'm glad, actually, that I... And I think McCartney did this as well. I'm not going to compare myself, obviously. But the underdog role he occupied really well, I think. And certainly by... I mean, there's interesting playing all over the early stuff as well, actually. It's just not quite as distinct. But when you get to sort of Rubber Soul onwards, it's a really authoritative presence.
Yes, definitely.
And it determines the movement of the songs.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think definitely the early stuff, there's just a lot. There's a lot of walking and there's a lot of the kind of country boom.
Yeah, and every now and then he gets bored and just hangs around on the tonic and the dominant.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
The first and the fifth of the chord.
There's always loads of variation though.
There's loads of variation.
You can tell. Yeah. I think that's him getting bored. Is that he barely plays the same thing twice.
What I really like about listening to his playing is, and this reminds me of the Harrison quote where he said, "If we knew we were going to be the Beatles, we might have tried a bit harder." I love that, which is a wonderful quote. And I know exactly what he means because one of the things that has such a lightness of touch about their music is that it's not overworked. It's not over-scrutinised.
Yeah.
And McCartney, as a bass player, I think he's probably pretty domineering anyway as a songwriter and as a musician in the studio and as someone who is ambitious for his group.
Yeah.
But no, you can tell no one said to him, "Hey, Paul, that second chorus isn't as strong as the first. Why don't you do the same thing as you did on the first?"
Yeah.
And so there are these moments where he makes quite strange choices.
Yeah, definitely.
And it doesn't repeat itself, and it's not actually as cellular. He doesn't quite have the pattern down, but he'll do one or two takes, and he's happy with it.
Yeah.
And there's much more life in it as a result because no one has over-scrutinised it, which is really rare for a bass player.
Well, in the Rick Rubin thing, he talks about doing something and coming up with the bass line more or less on the spot, so the really melodic thing. And
which is one of my favourites, actually.
Yeah.
It's
funny because I went down this kind of internet rabbit hole where I'm getting really into, like... Well, I really like the Plastic Ono Band at the moment since the reissues came out, and I really like Klaus Voormann's bass playing because it's very minimal and it's like the antithesis of McCartney. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of kind of Googling to see kind of what his reputation was. Like, do people think he was good or bad and everything? And so I found someone saying, like, they really like Klaus Voormann and they think McCartney's bass playing on something is offensive. Mm. This is on some forum because they said it sounded like he's trying to interrupt someone who's trying to talk. So Harrison's doing a solo, McCartney's basically like, "I'm here, can I?" Which is so funny, but it just... I sort of can see that, but like, at the same time, McCartney's bass playing makes that song for me.
Yeah, same here.
I think otherwise it would plod.
Yes.
Because it's so slow.
It is the song, really. Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant. It is a brilliant song in its own right.
But it's basically, it's counterpoint. It's he loves his Bach and he loves his Goldberg variations and stuff. And that's kind of where that, he's not punctuating chord progressions. He's making something really elegant that he weaves in and out of it and works completely in its own right.
Chord to the next to the next to the next melodically and find a different resonance within each chord because he's on the root and then he's on the third and then he's on the fifth and then he's on the seventh and he's sliding up. He taught me a lot about how to interpret harmony and I think because he was a guitar player and because he was a songwriter and he instinctively, even if he wasn't thinking, "Oh, I'm going to play the B in this G chord," he probably wasn't thinking like that, but his ear was and it taught me a lot about how you can navigate and lend a different emotional significance to certain chord sequences.
Definitely.
At the end of... it's a very obvious, very basic example, but it's so Beatles-y. The end of Carry That Weight or You Never Give Me Your Money, where the chord is C, G, A major.
Yeah.
And he plays
which I nicked, actually. I wrote a song when I was 13 called Read the Signs.
Nice.
Terrible.
And here's a clip of that.
And the chords
now.
Are the same, C, G, and A. I didn't realise for years that I'd actually nicked it from that. And I was playing upright double bass with my little band at school because it was easier than trying to find a cable to plug into an amp. Like in the morning before school, and I knew that these were the three chords of our terrible song, and I was just playing the roots, but something led me to play the B in the second chord, and it was transportive. Yeah. Moment. It really was. It was when I realised that you can make different selections and create a whole other melodic shape to what's happening underneath, which creates a different emotional significance to what's happening above. That was a really eye-opening moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, and yeah, the descending bass line thing is so signatory, isn't it, of what they do.
Do you know Kevin Ayers at all?
A bit, yeah.
There's an album he did with Mike Oldfield playing on the bass.
Oh, wow.
And there's a song called May I? And Mike Oldfield's bass playing is basically him going, I'm Mike Oldfield, all the way through. It's so intrusive. It's like almost comical. And like, I think that's what some people mistake McCartney for doing, but I don't think he's ever being that. It's never obtrusive, I don't think.
No, I don't think it is.
You hum the bass lines as if they're the hooks, you know, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. You know.
I think that's partly to do with the sound and how well it sits with the sound of Ringo's drums as well. And it's a lot of serendipity that goes on between the four of them. The individual musical relationships are really sympathetic.
Yeah.
That's why I was finding it quite strange that it's like DI'd in at the last minute.
Well, in some cases, I think. Yeah. Not
or is
all
that
the time.
In the sort of more produced stuff?
I think certainly on Pepper, when he was probably playing piano or guitar in the basic track. And then, but sometimes
he was playing the Rickenbacker on the.
Yeah.
On the
a bit more of the Rick by. By then, certainly.
Yeah. It's funny though, the fetishism of like bass sounds, because it's weird, isn't it? Because for a time it felt like there was a really long time when everyone was just obsessed with the bass sound on Scott 4.
Everyone's just Herbie Flowers, I think, isn't it? And Scott Walker himself played bass.
Yeah, but I can't remember if it was Scott Walker did play bass, but I'm not sure he played in that song. But it's weird how that sound is like, and the sound was almost accidental. You know, and the same with McCartney, but nowadays it's like, oh yeah, you've got to get that bass sound.
I've seen a hand, I've seen a vision, it was reaching through the clouds to risk a dream.
The shadow crossed. It's weird.
It's like, just flat rounds as well.
Was that flat round?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I think basically all basses were standard issue with flat rounds in the 60s.
I thought that was
round
like
rounds
a palm
came in later.
Thing.
Well, that as well. Yeah, yeah. And the bridges would have a bit of foam in or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those Rickenbackers have the screw up bridge mute.
Yeah.
Which mute strings. And
but it's weird how there's so much kind of time and energy spent discussing these things now as if that was the absolute pinnacle of how things could sound. Which obviously it does sound great, but like, at the time, it's kind of an accidental thing.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's just default.
Yeah.
I mean, seeing those bass amps when we went to Abbey Road the other day, like, surely there's only so much tinkering you can do with something like that.
How do you see yourself as a bass player in terms of, like, do you kind of take a lot from McCartney then, do you think, in terms of what you add to the songs?
I think that he has a way of jumping between registers, which I've long ripped off.
Right.
Sliding up.
Yeah, and understanding when it's, you know, register is one of the only tools you have at your disposal, really, because you're playing one note at a time, and choosing which octave to put that in is actually hugely impactful.
Yes.
And he tends to do that pretty well, and he tends to do it pretty varied as well. And I took that from him. I took the melodic aspect from him, because I just, you know, I just do want it to be quite bubbly, I suppose, underneath, for want of a better word. Where appropriate, I tend to get reined in by my bandmates.
Really?
I think every bass player does, really.
Yeah.
I think maybe he didn't.
Yeah. Because everything, the sound is busy.
It is.
And so the bass has to kind of find its own kind of voice. And some, you know, I love that. Like, one of my favourite songs of yours is Cough, Cough. And,
oh, thanks, yeah.
And the bass is doing so much in that. It's great. It's
pretty daft, that bass.
That's really great.
And that's another one where I thought, there are a lot of kind of... sort of bits in it. You should go drop to the semitone below, but instead I'll jump to the major seventh above.
Right.
Because it gives the same feeling, but it's a bit more jumpy. It's a bit more disjunct. It's a bit more interesting.
Songs where, like, when I first heard it, it was like, you know, you get a song you love and you just have to keep playing it, like, and like it's a bag of sweets that you keep eating and eating. But it's the chorus, the way the chorus is like, like, goes up a semitone, you just like want more of it. It's so weird. It's like, I'm just a real sucker for melodies that are weird, I think.
That's not un Beatlesy, that.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the chords are like G, A minor, B minor, F sharp major.
Right.
Which is kind of which is the weird thing about it.
Yeah.
Having that B flat in there.
Yeah.
In the F sharp major chord. As you say. Do you
sing when you play?
Yeah, we all sing a bit. Yeah, we all have to. It's quite a sort of big backing vocal commitment.
Yeah.
From everybody.
But that song in particular, like that, I mean... Yeah, I do think there's a Beatlesy thing in that. It's unusual melodically. It's got the kind of goosebumps thing with that moment. And, like, I mean, extraordinary vocal. Well, Jonathan's voice is quite amazing, isn't it? So, like...
Yeah, it's unusual.
So
yeah.
I wonder, how did that song kind of come together?
He had demoed this thing... I think he was trying to ape Single Ladies, where it's basically just vocals and drums.
Right.
And he just like wanted that for the verses, or One Thing by Emery, both of which are hugely significant tunes to our band.
Right.
Like, that's what we would put on when we were drunk.
Yeah.
And that's still what me and Mike DJ whenever we get a DJ booking. And yeah, exactly that, really. The really compelling sound of just rhythm and multiple voices, massed voices. Which is a really old thing going back to gospel, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we took it from that, and the chorus is a bit more fleshed out. It features this sample of John's own voice, which he took from a different song, which we didn't use. Like he somehow had his own voice, like a little melodic sample.
Yeah.
And we just worked it up by rehearsing. Alex's guitar line came from a different song that he just kind of readjusted it to fit the chords of that song.
Right.
It's quite the smorgasbord. And that's basically how we do everything.
Right, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
For every song that we release, there are probably two or three that have been butchered.
Right.
Right.
And then recreating it live, like, what you do, is it like, there's lots of keyboard, are you triggering samples?
A bit. Mostly we're able to just do it between the... Because we have a live keyboard player as well, Peter plays with us. So there are five people on stage, and we... just about have enough hands to cover it all.
That's so cool.
That's amazing. So when were you first aware of the Beatles? When were they first on your radar?
It kind of fits and starts, really. I think one of the first pop music experiences I ever had was this tape of nursery rhymes and children's songs and stuff by the King Singers. Do you know?
Yeah.
Do you know, I think they're still going.
The Queen is dead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Long live the King Singers. And they're one of those groups that's a bit like a Korean boy band or something. They just get replaced when they get to, like, you're 25, you're done, next one.
Mm.
So I think they still exist. I had this... We called it the red tape because it was a red cassette in the car. And I was 3 or 4 at this point. And it had silly nursery rhymes and stuff on them that my parents had got from the early learning centre or whatever. and they had a version of Yellow Submarine on it, which I was oddly fond of. And then within a year or so of that, my dad bought my mum the Live at Hollywood Bowl tape for her birthday. I hope he got her something else as well. This is probably about 1989, I suppose. So I was about five. And I was really captivated by that. I didn't really understand what it was or who these people were. I just thought the sound of it was so amazing. And that album opens with Twist and Shout, and it's the sound of them singing through that arpeggio. Sort of everyone checking in individually, like the beginning of Ghostbusters. And the crowd's going bananas. And
what
it's just,
tour
it's
is that? Is that
exciting.
On the 65,
I think.
That's 65. I don't think I've ever heard that.
It's funny because like their recorded work at that point and their touring work were really quite far apart because the touring work, they're still a sort of R&B bar band.
I find playing it, songs that go back to Hamburg.
I find it just extraordinary to think they toured after Revolver.
I know. It's bizarre really when you see it as well. The Candlesticks Pass. The last ever concert in San Francisco. Yeah. They look fed up. So I had those very early experiences when I was 5, 6, 7. Then round, when was McCartney born? Whenever he was 50, ITV put a load of Beatles programming on.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Including the films, The Help and Hard Day's Night. And
this was quite,
quite
formative for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so for anybody of our sort of age, I think.
92, that maybe.
Probably,
that
something like that, yeah. And my parents take them off the telly. And I can still see it now, the kind of ident card before they went to the ads, McCartney at 50. Mm-hmm. And there was Help and there was Hard Day's Night. I was more interested in Help because it was colour and because it was full of loads of stupid silliness. It's quite problematic now.
Yes.
I
know you've
on
touched
BBC
on this
two
before.
Now,
we don't need to go over that again, I don't think. Hard Day's Night is clearly superior.
Yeah.
But I was interested in them as a group of people and the camaraderie and the sort of silliness of it as much as I was interested in the music, actually, at that time. So then there was that phase. And then I suppose it was sort of bleeding into the mid-90s when they had this whole renaissance through Britpop, which I did overlap with. Free as a Bird is on Top of the Pops, you know. And the anthologies were on the telly. And I started to get some of the albums from the library and tape them. And and then another renaissance again at the other end of my teens, having been through quite an awkward mid to late teens period when I just wanted to listen to American post-hardcore that was in 7-8.
Right.
Which,
like Tool and
Converge or
something. Well, a bit of that, but like the Slint shellac end of it. I only listened to that kind of music for about 3 years.
Wicked.
And then when I got to university, I was glad of that education.
It's
in
a pretty good embarrassing phase to go through.
There's a whole other podcast in this, but weirdly, I grew up in Tunbridge Wells in Kent, which is a very safe Tory town. But weirdly, the sound of bands in that town was like Chicago in 1992.
Right,
it wasn't at all what it should have been, or what you'd expect, which was fucking great to grow up with. Really good. And then when I got to university and just kind of threw off the sort of India the Now shackles, the ATP stuff, I was really glad to re-embrace the Beatles. Not that I ever thought that they were anything less than wonderful, but there was definitely a kind of... I definitely grew up with a lot of people who were sick to death of them being canonised in that way.
Yeah.
And didn't think that they got a free pass just because they're the Beatles.
There was a lot.
I understand that.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of that in the 90s.
There was.
Like, I'm sick of hearing the Beatles. Sick of Oasis. And definitely.
I can understand it.
I think it's really interesting. Like, a lot of people have that formative experience with that music, you know, Slint and shellac, because it was like, and Tortoise as well, where you're just really, because it's a way of getting super into playing.
Yeah,
because they were such good players.
Great players, but the wonderful thing about it is it's not great players in the way that, like a hair, like Whitesnake are taking. Everyone's doing their part quietly and with a sense of servitude to the greater good, which is actually, I think, is hugely part of what the Beatles do.
Yes, totally.
Because I love Zeppelin. I'm not really an aficionado, but whenever I hear them, I think, wow, great players. But they're not really doing their thing quietly, are they? That's because they're sort of stinkers.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's playing all over it. Everyone's insisting upon themselves. Mm. One of the wonderful things about the Beatles as players was that they were only ever serving the song.
Really. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And nobody oversteps that mark.
No.
With one exception, which we'll come on to later, for my controversial opinion.
Oh, cool.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it's strange that Slint, of all the that kind of scene, and now having a little bit of a renaissance with, like, the Gen Zers, and bands like, you know, Black Country New Road and stuff. It's like, I think, and this new Black generation MIDI. Black MIDI of, like, really proficient young people who you're wondering where the fuck they get their music.
I know, it's brilliant.
Influence from. And I mean, they're the same kind of people. Like, they're all, you know, they look like they've just finished their GCSEs, and then they're playing like these incredible, like, saxophone lines, and this whole jet. And I suppose it's the same as the sort of emerging London jazz scene now, of like these. Is it the Spotification of people's listening habits, do you think?
Yeah. It's possibly. I guess you've got more access there to these records. I had to work really hard to hear Spiderland and to find it. And
when there was like an album that was just like, I was in America. So whenever you were in America when you were young, I was lucky enough to go a few times and you buy records. Like, I remember getting a Gastro del Sol album and like this really like experimental noisy. And then at the end, there's like John McIntyre playing this groove. And like two guitar lines going in out of sync, and it was like, oh my god, it's amazing. And like then like, you'd meet people and go, yeah, that's like why I play the drums.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's like this obscure album, like just right at the end of the album. We'll have to play a clip of it. It's fucking amazing.
Yeah. I don't think I'm familiar with that. I'd love to hear it.
It's on Cracked, Crooked or Fly.
Right.
It's really, really good.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's a bit in Revolution in the Head where he talks about how Lennon is truth and McCartney is beauty, kind of. Do you remember that? That kind of
It's lovely.
Dichotomy.
Yeah.
And it seems like Everything Everything is kind of more of a truth band. Like, it's quite
That's nice. Oh, thanks.
yeah, you're really ugly.
It's interesting you say that.
But you seem like your songs are very like ideas band in a way. Do you think that's fair? Or do you think, like...
Yeah, I suppose so. We worked, in every sense, an ideas band, maybe, yeah. We worked with James Ford, who produced our fourth record, and he'd done loads of stuff with... I mean, he's just done a huge catalogue of amazing records, with most notably, I guess, Arctic Monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically produced all their work. And on at the end of the first day, we all went outside for a cig, and he was like... a little bit overwhelmed. He was like, no one's phoning it in, are they? You're all full of ideas.
Yeah.
And it's his job was to try and distill all of that stuff and make everybody feel heard, but also ignored to the right levels.
Yeah.
I remember him being taken aback by how brimming with... enterprise everybody was. I think we've got a little bit better in the last 4 years since then at picking our battles, maybe.
But I mean, it's not just musically. I mean, the song lyrically
conceptually
very
I think every album we've been quite conscious of what it is we're trying to say and what it is we're talking about, and certainly since the second record we've known how important it is to talk about and to understand even before you put pen to paper or put anything to tape what it is you're trying to communicate.
And do you all write lyrics, or does Jonathan?
No, Jonathan writes all the lyrics, and we hear them or read them or both, and will say, "I think you need to maybe think about this, or have you thought about this?" I mean, none of us would ever claim to be lyricists apart from Jonathan. He is the lyricist, but we do all have some input. We were arguing today about titles.
But so some of Jonathan's lyrics are about very specific things. Like there's a song about recruiting ISIS terrorists. There's a song about fighting with a fatberg.
Praying to a sentient fatberg.
Yeah.
That was in the kind of demo email. It's like, here we go, lads. Here's a song about praying to a sentient fatberg.
They're about very specific things, but they don't knock you around the head with them. It's not like, so one day there was this sentient fatberg. They're not like kind of that, which is like, lyrics should be kind of between things, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, because actually John and I talked about Martha My Dear not long ago, and he was like, what, it's about a sheepdog?
Yeah.
And I just thought it was about a girl. And it could be.
Yeah.
And it's a very tender, sweet, indulgent love song to a sentient being. Doesn't matter if it's a woman or a sheepdog, as it turns out. And that's quite a crass example of how you can broaden things so that they are open to interpretation. So if you want to read about the fatberg angle, I mean, that's actually a little bit more explicit on that song than some are. Yeah. But I think he's quite conscious of wanting to make things subtle enough to not get in the way of your enjoyment.
Yeah.
It's not Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Martha, My Dear, I think we were saying this in one episode. There's some interview somewhere where Paul McCartney once said his muse was called Martha. So he would call, like, if he'd written a good song, he'd be saying like he was talking to Martha or something.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, so Martha is named after the sheepdog is named after the muse.
Right. So it makes a lot of sense of the "you've always been my inspiration" kind of thing.
Sounds like a bit of a get out of jail free card. Yeah, you write a song about a dog that everyone's missing to.
I prefer it being about a dog. But there's a really good. Anyway, that was by the by. But there's a really good. Do you know Kaz McCombs?
I know of him. Yeah.
I can't believe I haven't mentioned it on the podcast yet, because he's, I love him beyond language. But he's got a brilliant song called "Bum Bum Bum," which is kind of a silly name. But
I've just been on holiday with a 2-year-old who's got the same song.
Yeah. Exactly. But it seems to be a song about how you can't write a protest song now, and it's really good because it's basically kind of saying it's sort of about, you can't really have definite answers, you know. The best songs ask questions, really, don't they? Do you know, like, if there's a song that's really, you know, television, the voice of a nation kind of thing,
it's a bit
hitting you around the head.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Because it's sort of, with Thom Yorke especially, I think that when he's too on the nose, it actually is the only time where, you know, songs like Harrow Downhill or some of the sort of Iraq war-y type stuff. And that comes from sort of deciding what your concept of an album is going to be before you write it. And then I guess you feel bound to make this an album about Brexit or a war or whatever it is. So once you've decided conceptually what an album's going to be, how close does it resemble that by the time it's finished? So I imagine something like Sgt. Pepper is the example of, like, starts off as this kind of amazing concept album and becomes something different.
And yet the overall feeling conveyed by the title and the opening track is enough to sustain you through to the reprise and life, isn't it? Even though, when I'm 64, lovely, they don't really contribute to the...
No.
But there are enough sort of spikes in it, like... Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, that kind of thing that contributes to this feeling of a sort of carnival or a circus or something, I suppose. I guess our most conceptually hefty record was Get to Heaven. And John wanted to make a really murderous record. You know, he He wanted it to be terrorized and terrorizing, because that was the tenor of the times. And it was tempered by the fact that the rest of us wanted to offset that by making the music as colourful and as vibrant as we could, and not as grim, I suppose. Mm. And actually, so did he. And inevitably, over time, the sort of the heaviness of that message becomes not diluted, but a bit more saturated into a bigger musical picture. Mm. So that I think we just about balanced that on that album. The other records haven't been quite so. They've not had to do so much heavy lifting in their own right.
And do you sort of think about what your kind of influence is going to be in quite an explicit way, sort of musically as well?
Yeah.
One thing that really surprised me about chatting to the Field Music guys and their brilliant, their podcast, which is amazing, is just how methodical they were in the way. And they didn't always end up being like that, but they were like, this is going to be, today I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a song like Bob Dylan would have written a song or whatever.
Yeah, each record has a different directive, I think, stylistically, aesthetically, musically, we'll be drawing from certain sources, certain influences. This newest stuff that we're working on certainly does.
Yeah, I was going to say the new single is a lot kind of calmer. It seems calmer, maybe a bit more. Is that
Mercury and Me? Yeah, that was a song that we just liked a lot and couldn't really fit on the last record. It's not in any way indicative of what's coming next, to be honest.
Right,
that's always the way with us.
Yeah,
we do try to set out certain parameters at the beginning of a process, somewhat arbitrarily, but it's a good way to kick things off. Inevitably, it ends up being bastardized. It does, but you've got to have some parameters this far into a career. You have to say, we are going to do this. We're not going to go below this level of energy. We are going to have some tenderness, or we're not. I mean, on Get to Heaven, we set the low bar very early on, which was the closing track, Warm Healer, and we said, we're not going to go below this level of energy. Everything else has to be up and hard and fast and that seemed to work pretty well for us on that album. Playing every song from that album live when we toured it, which is quite a rare privilege for any band, I think.
And how were audiences responding?
Really well. Yeah. We could play 11 songs from a new album. And I think occasionally in a career, maybe not even more than once, you'll get this confluence whereby the new album is also the album people want to hear.
Yeah.
Whereas normally it takes an album or two for people to be like, I really want to hear.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Well, tell that to Paul McCartney.
Well, exactly. Yeah. He's still playing despite all the danger. That album was, 5-6 years ago? And almost immediately it was the record that people wanted to hear when they came to the shows. Whereas on some of the other records, you need a few years digestion.
Do you think that was a combination of the, because there are catchy songs on that album?
I think
Distant Past is on that album.
It was super catchy stuff. It was stuff that had a lot of radio play. It was stuff that connected with people personally and emotionally very, very quickly. It's just one of those happy confluences, I think.
Reminds me of back in the day, well, you know, in the noughties, seeing Animal Collective when they toured, and they would always play the next album. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah.
Like they'd be touring one album and playing songs from the next one.
There seems to be a bit of a habit of over the last few years of people playing their new album in like track by track order as well. In the sort of the first half of the show and then kind of doing the hits.
Yeah.
Which seems to be
specific. Yeah, we've talked about doing that, given that our next tour will have to be our fifth album and our sixth album kind of bundled together, because we obviously weren't able to tour our fifth album during the pandemic, and we'll have another one out by by the time we tour, we hope.
Playing
two albums back to back, going off, coming back and doing greatest hits encore.
Yeah.
I'd like to reassure everybody that we're not going to do that.
Yeah. Have you got a tour coming up?
We've got shows on sale for April of next year, which have already been rescheduled two or three times.
Yeah. How did you find it in that period where... I think touring was, you know, not.
We
on the
were lucky in some respects in that we had finished an album and the audio had literally been tied up within a couple of weeks of the first lockdown. So at least we had something to promote throughout that first summer.
Mm.
And then it came out in the September and we weren't really able to give it a longer life.
Mm.
Once it's out, it's out. We weren't able to have a touring, a live expression of that music. So it just kind of withered on the vine, which was a shame. We were pleased with its reception and it charted well and all that bollocks, but it you can't make it live in people's consciousness.
That's a really interesting thing. Very long. It reminds me a bit of, I mean, this isn't just me trying to get it back to the Beatles, but there's an interesting thing someone's talking about, the idea of legacy. I mean, you know, someone was using the analogy of maintaining the Beatles' legacy as being like you've got two or three matches left to keep a fire going.
Yeah.
And you can only use one once. You can't use them all together. You know, but there is a similar thing with just being in a band now, isn't there? You've got to think about how you're going to plug the gaps and satisfy your audiences and keep things new and fresh.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Have you thought about? Have you ever done? I was sort of I'm only thinking of this because I listened to the Def Heaven album the other day.
Oh yeah.
I'm like, they've taken such a U-turn. Have you ever thought about doing something like that, because they were doing the kind of black metal shoegaze thing, and then they've just released a kind of quite straightforward pop album, basically.
Right.
Well, it's a shoegaze album, but there's no growling on it. But like, have you ever thought about doing something? Have you ever considered that as like a big U-turn kind of thing? Or
not really, because I think we set out our stall pretty broadly to begin with.
Yeah.
So our first record kind of gave us 12 different directions to go in, and we didn't choose any one of them. We just have kind of always been quite a broad palette anyway, I think. So we don't feel the need to do anything stylistically opposite to what we've done before because it's always quite broad. I mean, the stuff that we've been working on the last couple of weeks runs the full gamut, really, I would say, of like upbeat, up-tempo electronica and slow stoner guitar music, which has basically been our sort of twin pillars all the way through, really.
That's cool.
I think because we grew up with like Radiohead Mark II as our guiding lights, whereby anything was possible.
Yeah,
you can be a rock band who bought the Warp catalogue and channeled that.
Yeah.
That's always informed what we've done, really.
Yeah.
We've just always tried to keep it quite broad.
I think the UK is really bad at nurturing experimental bands, I think. And, you know, I think American bands, I'm not saying they have it easier, but I think for bands like yourselves and Folds, it's sort of, you have a following, but I think people sometimes get like a bit sniffy about UK bands and they would, in the way they wouldn't be about American
bands.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
Same thing.
Yeah, I think it has always been a something of an uphill struggle for any band with any vaguely experimental bent. Canada does it well as well, doesn't it? Literally funds bands at a sort of grassroots level.
But I
guess, and also, I mean, I remember when you first came on the scene, you were very rarely described as a band without a Manchester band being a front, so that comes with a lot of baggage when you're really not anything like a Manchester band.
No, and yet we also are, I would argue, because none of us are born and bred in Manchester, but we spent all our adult lives here. And
but I mean, you don't represent what immediately springs to mind when you say
no. And yet, what immediately springs to mind, it depends who you ask, because I don't think there's any commonality between how the Bee Gees, 10cc, the Smiths, Joy Division, New Order, obviously there's an overlap there,
Oasis,
Doves, Elbow, Stone Roses. What they have in common is the desire to do something different.
Yeah.
It's the spirit of radicalism thing that we mentioned before.
Yeah.
There is a sort of baggy swagger that runs through some of those bands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
the Roses and the Mondays, I suppose.
Mm.
And to a lesser extent, the Order. But they're very different sounding groups, by and large, and they've always wanted to do something different to what was big before, simply Red. You know, I would argue that we carried that torch, at least.
Yeah.
Mm.
There was a moment about 10, 12 years ago in Manchester when our band, Dutch Uncles, Delphic, Egyptian Hip Hop, were kind of seized upon by the press as the sort of new Manchester scene or sound. And actually, none of those bands sounded particularly alike either.
There's three things.
But there was an attitude. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's get them all together for a photo shoot.
Yeah.
Stevenson Square, which we did do. There was an attitude that was deliberately trying to eschew the Factory legacy. And I say that as an enormous fan and hugely respectful of what Factory have done and for Manchester. I actually lived in the old Factory offices flat.
Really?
So I paid my rent to Alan Erasmus, who was one of the Factory directors. And when I got my tenancy agreement, I signed it with Factory Communications Limited. Apparently, I had a flat number as a tenant. Yeah, as a tenant of 86 Palatine Road. Yeah,
that's so in funny. Blood.
The thing about Factory that's got lost in its recent representation by some of its proponents is that it was modernist and futurist and radical. And it was nothing to do with this sort of black and white stripy tourism, or yellow and black, I should say.
Yeah,
you know, the Hacienda stuff that's trotted out. That's not culture. That's tourism.
But like I'm sure I said before, like the 90s seemed to be the first decade, very broadly speaking, where people were looking back instead of looking forward.
Mm.
Mm.
And I think
that's true. Yeah,
Manchester, the kind of nostalgia of Manchester, it's kind of missing out how forward thinking it was, you know?
It was, and also when you actually objectively listen to some of those bands, like the Happy Mondays, where did they get that from? What were they listening
that really
to?
Came from the ether, didn't it?
It really did. And they're extraordinary in that respect.
Where are the Beatles at in your life now? Like, do they occupy a place now? Do you listen to them often? Are they kind of part?
I do listen to them often, and I have a couple of close friends in particular where basically the only thing we do is get together and talk about and listen to the Beatles. Basically, do what we're doing now. Yeah, on the mics. My good friends Nathan and Tom. I was doing it last night with Nathan, in fact. I guess represent a certain sanctuary. There's always a warmth and a kind of connection to the sublime that you get from listening to the Beatles, which I find enormously nourishing. And it's still, I kind of wish there was more music, but I'm also glad there isn't.
Like,
I'd love more to listen to, but I'm glad they didn't make it.
I mean, there's enough in that short.
There's loads.
Because it's there so homely, loads. And if there was more, you know, I always ended up, you know, if I've been away, like, for abroad for an extended period of time, I always find myself listening to the Beatles because it's like, it's home, it's comfort food for the ears.
Yes, absolutely.
But without being reductive about it.
Exactly. So I it's a very personal thing, and it's still something I can enjoy with other people, you know, collectively. Sometimes with other bands especially, I've had to take a deliberate break because I've overdone it. I went to the first ever, and I think probably the only ever, academic conference on Kraftwerk.
Oh, really?
Aston University.
Wow, cool.
Instead of going to the mastering session for Get to Heaven, I was just like, fuck this, I've heard this record now. So I went to Aston University for a 2-day academic conference in Birmingham with a mate of mine who was equally fanatical. And after that, I was like, yeah, I think I might give it a rest. I think I might have overdone it.
Yeah.
Like, binged on it. And whereas with the Beatles, I don't ever really feel that. The speed with which they move from one guise to the next is so quick within a 7-8-year period that actually there's always a different angle to investigate. I think, you know that... was it Dan Lissack and Scroobius Pibb did that song where it's like the Pixies are just a band. Radiohead are just a band. That's really healthy. And really true. And the only disagreement I have is that the Beatles are not just a band, but they are actually a sort of cultural prism by which to view that post-war Britain, post-war globe period, really.
Yeah.
I think that they encapsulate a great deal more than they intended to. And loads of that has been forced upon them.
I think that's that's interesting. Forced upon.
Because it's
been
interesting. George Harrison's always, he will always play down the Beatles phenomena. And, you know, say, you know, we weren't that good and all of that sort of thing. But I suppose you kind of have to do that if you were there, because otherwise you'll go insane. Which is why I think Paul's kind of disconnected himself by saying that, you know, I'm just a fan of the band, you know.
Like teed up the fact you've got a controversial Beatles opinion.
Well, and Jack highlighted that this is the only consistent question.
And the clue was that it was a time. What, do the clue again?
I said, what were we talking about?
Them being sort of performative.
I said, I love.
Beyond the needs of the song.
That's right. Yes. I think that the 70s spills over into a period where people are. Indulging themselves more than they're serving the song, and that they basically stayed the right side of that.
So, is your controversial Beatles opinion about the second side of Abbey Road then?
No.
Oh, that's what that was my guess.
No, thought it would I be about the end. I adore that.
Okay. Yeah. I thought it would be the drum solo and everything.
Well, because it spills over into sort of prog and
because
it's long form.
Yeah.
No, I love that. I think it encapsulates everything that they've done up to that point.
Let's have another guess.
It's a specific song, as opposed, like, I think that's that suite is a work of genius. Classical form.
Yeah.
I can see why you'd think that.
Yeah,
it's because of the way I've teed this up. Yeah. No, I quite strongly dislike While My Guitar Gently.
That's what I was about to guess.
You got it right.
Yeah.
Because of Clapton,
it's flashy in
it's,
a way that
it insists upon itself. It goes on for too long.
Yeah,
you're listening to three or four guitar solos.
I hate the bass.
It's not lovely. It's a very unusual sound. It's almost like it's got two octaves on it or something.
Yeah.
Well, it's very picky and cling cling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Clung, clung, clung. It's not really. I think McDonald said it has an obstinate quality.
Yeah.
Which is the best way to put it, because it does. It really. It stays in one place. It really insists upon itself.
Yeah.
You're being made to listen to someone who is saying, "I'm playing the guitar, and that should be enough for you."
Do you have that story about George Harrison and Eric Clapton tried to kind of woo Patti Boyd by playing? Like basically out soloing each other,
right? That sounds awful.
Yeah, it does.
Surprising.
That's it. Do you like the acoustic version on Anthology?
I don't. Oh no, I have heard that. Yeah, it's I do. And that was the demo as well, like the Isha demo, because they all came out more recently, didn't they?
I'm not sure if it's the Isha one. Or
it was. I just remember it from the documentary where it played out part five. I remember that blowing my mind. Because it's so lovely. I mean, that version of it, if it was on All Things Must Pass or something, I would...
I used to love it. I don't have a lot of love for it now. But that is really interesting, because it is certainly a song that is looking towards the indulgence of the 70s, isn't it?
It is,
I mean, you can see a creamy kind of, obviously, the Clapton element, but there's something about that.
I don't really appreciate the presence of a different personality on it. That's the thing that I dislike about it.
Yeah.
Why have we opened the door? We. Why have they opened the door to something that's going to bastardize the otherwise very?
Yeah. I mean, you get. But I mean, I love what Billy Preston does, but
same.
That's actually, the restraint of him sort of melting into the background and.
Yeah.
You know, keeping everything going. There's nothing. Even the solos. I mean, I love the Trident. Stuff where he really goes for it on I Want You She's So Heavy on the Sgt. Pepper ones that have come out recently. Amazing.
Yeah.
Just because it's so nice to hear him like properly rip it up.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that's not the version on the album, because it's just, you know, he's there to, in the same way that George Martin used to sit in, just as a proficient key player.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose that's the other thing. When you picture the Beatles and they've got that sort of perfect symmetry with Paul with his left-handed bass and Lennon with his right-handed guitar and
there are four people on stage. Nobody's sitting at the Joanna, so you can kind of accept Billy Preston as an add-on entity. Whereas another gunslinger in the form of Clapton is quite unwelcome in my mind. And also, I just don't like him. No. I don't like him. I don't like his music. I don't like the whole attitude of being a guitarist first and a musician second. Is dangerous territory.
So that was Jeremy Pritchard's Personal Beatles. A really, really enjoyable chat. Really love that one.
Yeah, what a nice guy. And just that was a really fun conversation with pizza and beer. I think the pizza arrived at a really kind of, you know...
Yeah, I should have said there's a doorbell in this that was very hard to edit out, but it hit such a perfect moment. I left it in there. So... I think we allude to the fact that we were also eating at the same time.
Yeah.
But conversation carried on into the pub. A few more extra pints and equally good. Shame we didn't record it. But it was really brilliant. And as Jeremy mentioned, he sort of came to us asking to come on the pod. So we're really grateful for him.
Yeah, that was really flattering.
It was great. Really glad that he enjoyed it. And we hope you enjoyed it too, children. Mm. We'll be back next week with a really exciting guest, John Bradley, who's a brilliant actor. Most people might know from Game of Thrones and such like, and a massive Beatles fan.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun.
And you're quite a big throny, aren't you, as David Cameron pretended to be.
Really? Did David Cameron say throny?
He did a sort of really opportunistic video from the set in Belfast going like, I'm incredibly excited to be here, especially as I'm a massive throny.
Oh, my God.
Which, obviously, no one had ever said before.
Yeah. No, I'm really excited about this. I've read the books and seen all the episodes. It's going to be brilliant. Yeah, but a huge, huge Beatles fan. He's done the Egg Pod as well. It'll be really interesting.
As you know. Oh, cool. Might listen to that. So we'll be back next Tuesday with John Bradley. Until then, thank you so much for listening. Please give us a rating if you enjoyed the show. You can get an extended version of that episode, as always, on Patreon. And we'll be back next week.
Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.